introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here talking to you about this work that I did during my stay at Perimeter in the last few months. So I went for a conference from here, and then I heard about superconductivity in this fascinating system. Then there is an old idea in this field of superconductivity, namely Skirmion superconductivity. And I thought it's very applicable in this particular situation. So that's what I will share with you today. So after a brief introduction, I will go into the phenomenology and then model building, and then talk about Skirmions and then some consequences. Now, if you look at the history of superconductivity, which is 100 years old now, it all started in 1911 with Kemmerling once discovering superconductivity in a very beautiful and simple elemental metal, mercury. You can't imagine anything better. It's no complication of multiple phases. It's a very clean metal, and it becomes superconducting, but unfortunately at very low temperatures. Then people recognize the significance of this novel quantum state, Meissner effect, and a variety of wonderful things. So they wanted to increase the transition temperature. New materials were cooked, and slowly there was progress until 1986, when some revolutionary progress took place. Bednarz and Muller discovered superconductivity in cuprate, and then that really changed the scene in the field of superconductivity. So this is a historical timeline, and you can see that there is a lot of activity now to create new materials, and everybody wants to touch the sky, namely room temperature superconductivity, but the efforts are, the progress is there, but still slow. We have not reached room temperature superconductivity. The highest temperature we have is in this material at 163 degree Kelvin under pressure, but still it's remarkably high material compared to what one had at the end of the beginning of 1986. Niobium-3 germanium was showing 23 degree Kelvin superconductivity. So all this, that graph shows that there are several attempts experimentally to reach create higher temperature superconductor. And of course, whenever in physics we try to create novel materials with novel properties, there is also a lot of physics that emerges. New physics continues to come. And on the theoretical front, there has been several mechanism of Little and Ginsberg, who suggested that you could reach room temperature superconductivity under some conditions. Then similarly, hydrogen under pressure is also, according to theory, will become a room temperature superconductor at enormously high pressure, which has not been reached so far. Now, this theory, resonating valence bond mechanism, initiated by P.W. Anderson, started with this discovery of superconductivity in cuprate. This also shows some nice direction for future progress. Okay. Now, when we think about superconductivity, our knowledge, what we learn in our solid-state physics courses, you need a Fermi C, and then a well-defined Fermi C. That's what happens in metal like mercury or lead, in elemental superconductors. You have a Fermi C. Then quasi-particles that live close to the Fermi surface, they undergo scattering, or you can say they undergo scattering due to exchange of phonon quanta. And that leads to the matrix element for scattering, which is negative, which is equivalent to some kind of attraction in K space between two electrons. So that leads to your famous Cooper instability. I will not go into the detail. And then you get a BCS superconducting state. And this took nearly 50 years of the discovery of Kemmerling ones to come to a great understanding and a deep understanding. That's a BCS theory. And if you look at the physics of this state, the fraction of electrons that actually participate in superconductivity is very tiny. In a sense, all the electrons are quiescent and calm deep inside the Fermi C. Only a tiny fraction, which is h cross omega d, which is the Debye energy divided by Fermi energy. Fermi energy is typically 10 electron volt, 5 electron volt. Each one electron volt is 10,000 Kelvin. It's a large number. And the Debye frequency is like 500 Kelvin. 400 Kelvin, 600 Kelvin. So only a small fraction of electrons do participate. That's why when you look at the scale of temperature of superconductivity, it's tiny. It's nothing to do with Fermi energy or Debye energy. It's 5 Kelvin, 3 Kelvin. So if you take any elemental superconductor, or most of the majority of the superconductors, the TC is very low. So Fermi liquid, which has acted like a good reference state to understand superconductivity, seems to be also inhibiting possibility of high temperature superconductivity. In fact, if you look at the expression for BCS, transition temperature, this is a beautiful, famous expression. You have cross omega D, and you have electron density of states at the Fermi level and electron form and coupling constant. So people wanted to increase the Debye frequency or increase the electron density of states at the Fermi level or increase the electron form and coupling constant. But it turns out, even though they occur in three different places, in a real material, they are all interconnected. This is what was shown by the famous work of Macmillan, Anderson, and Cohen, that there are serious constraints coming from stability of the solid. That is, you cannot make all of them arbitrary large. If one increases, the other decreases. So you can, in fact, these people suggested that you cannot go beyond 30 Kelvin. So there is a big stumbling block for making progress. Then came a surprise. Okay, so yeah, this is what I already said. Now, how do we make more electron participate? So the fraction of electrons participating in superconductivity is small. How do we make it increase the participation? So this is where discovery by Budnaz and Muller showed a new way. Namely, you don't start with a Fermi C, you start with a Mott insulator, and then there is a possibility more fraction of charges will participate in superconductivity, the scale will be different. This is at the heart of resonating valence bond state theory. I will very quickly go through that. In order to appreciate this, we need to understand the Mott insulator. All of you know about it, but let me at the same time mention it. This is the thought experiment that Mott did several years ago, that suppose you have a collection of hydrogen atoms forming a solid, and suppose you are changing the lattice parameter at will by tuning some knob. When the lattice parameter is comparable to Bohr radius, the wave functions will overlap, and there will be screening, and then electrons will tunnel, and you will get a simple metal. And mostly, the oneness state of hydrogen atom will participate, so you'll get a very simple tight bending band containing so many number of block states. And each block state will be occupied by two electrons, so you'll have a half-filled band. So this is the nature of a metallic state when the lattice parameter is comparable to Bohr radius or smaller. Suppose you adiabatically expand this lattice and ask the question, what will happen? A stage will come in which it will no more be energetically favorable for electron to form a block state, because in order to form a block state, I have to, for example, in a situation like this, I have to ionize myself from this atom that causes energy and then put myself on top of another neutral atom. So that may also cause some energy. So the electron affinity plus ionization energy becomes larger than the bandwidth. When it becomes larger than the bandwidth, you have a situation in which electrons will rather sit at home and don't conduct. So this is a simple Mott insulator. Now, even though formally it looks very simple, you notice that there are hidden degrees of freedom which are going to make life complicated. For example, in a band insulator like helium atom, you can imagine similar situation, but there will be two electrons filling up the oneness shell. So there is no spin degree of freedom, and there is no charge degree of freedom. So you have a gap for creating charge and spin excitation. Here you notice the spins are essentially free. So you have created a situation in which charges cannot move because of this commensurate one electron per orbital situation and a large lattice parameter, and whereas spins are nearly free. So schematically you represent the charge excitation in terms of lower Hubbard band and upper Hubbard band. That is, if you want to pluck out an electron, it needs some energy. That will be the whole band. And if you add an electron, that will be, again, some finite energy. That will be the upper Hubbard band. Now, however, in such a situation, there is a new physics that emerges. Namely, electrons won't sit idle. They would like to delocalize and make at least do some quantum dynamics. What you find is, if you consider two neighboring orbitals, if the spins have some singlet component like this, an electron can hop to a neighboring site and go back, for example, in an exchange configuration. So this is a virtual transition. So This virtual mixing to this excited state leads to a gain in energy, if you do second order perturbation theory, which is in terms of Hopping matrix element and the intermediate state energy U is this. So this is what we call as kinetic exchange or super exchange energy. And what is remarkable is that this process is blocked if you have parallel spins because of Pauli principle. So Pauli principle, together with Coulomb interaction, distinguishes a spin triplet state from, say, a spin singlet state from a spin triplet state. So that's the beginning of magnetism in a solid like this. So it says that two neighboring spins have a spin-spin coupling, which in that reduced Hilbert space or low energy Hilbert space is represented as a Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So if you consider them in pairs, the natural ground state is this entangled state, a singlet state. So for example, you can minimize the energy to some extent by ordering singlet bonds like this, or you can allow them to resonate and gain more energy. Normally, we classically think of ordering the spins in terms of an antiferromagnet. Once you have an antiferromagnetic coupling and a spin interaction like this, but once you have quantum spins and reduced dimension and geometrical frustration, it's more convenient to think along this line. So the picture that emerges is the following, that the lanthanum copper oxide, which is a Martin insulator, at very short time scale, it will look like this. You will have essentially free spins, and then there are some so-called doped holes. Because you have a Martin insulator and remove some carrier, the doped holes are here. So you have a situation which is rather different from a block state, in which electrons go into a plane wave or block state and then fill up a Fermi. See, here you have some real space situation. And of course, this is not the full story because of the super exchange I talked about. There will be singlet coupling between electrons, and there may be a site which is an unpaired spin like that. So, of course, this is a kind of frozen state. If you act on this state with the Hamiltonian, the holes will move and the singlets will move. So there will be a lot of resonance and singlet physics. So this is something that does not happen in a metal like mercury. It happens in a correlated oxide like lanthanum copper oxide. So according to Anderson, this is the best way to think about superconductivity in lanthanum copper oxide. You don't have a Fermi C to begin with. What you have to begin with is a localized situation like this. No Fermi C, and then electrons have spin degrees of freedom. They're weakly coupled, and then you dope the system. Now, what is very important is these singlets play the role of singlets that were there in the BCS theory through weak scattering of electrons at the Fermi surface. So here you have your quantum chemistry, or overlap of orbitals and tunneling leads to, yes, distinction between a singlet and triplet state. So this exchange energy, in cube rate, is about 1,500 degree Kelvin. So you have created a situation in which you have created singlets in real space. The only thing is you should allow them to move and delocalize and create a coherent state, which will be a superconducting state. And that's what Anderson suggested in his famous paper that in the Science magazine, that singlet correlations arising from antiferromagnetic coupling in a Martin insulator are pre-existing neutral Cooper pairs. They carry spin current and no charge current in the Martin insulator. So just dope them. Then once you have space for the singlets to move, they start moving and delocalizing. You get this beautiful superconducting state with scales of energy or condensation energy, which is very different from what BCS theory will give you. For example, if you look at if you summarize, look at message from resonating valence board theory is that Martin insulators at seats of height and the super exchange is the blue, the two side thing that I talked about. So the fraction of electrons participating is not this, but X, which is the density of hole that I showed. So instead of being 0.01%, suddenly you have a possibility 5% of the hole will participate in superconductivity. Now, while all these things are easily described, when you come to do mathematics, many-body theory, it has been extremely challenging. That's why in the last 25 years, people have been struggling hard to understand this strong coupling problem, to develop theories and techniques, and to make it more quantitative. That continues to remain as a challenge, even though we have got schematically a very good picture of what's going on, thanks to experiments and very many approximation methods. Okay, so this is the story. Now, another message from resonating valence bond state theory that came right in the beginning is that I mentioned that if you have spins, they are, because of antiferromagnetic coupling, they could order antiferromagnetically. It was suggested by Polyakov, Wigman, and Zyroshinsky, and then around the same time by Anderson and the group, that you could imagine in an ordered spin state, excitations, which are topological, which could do this pairing, and you could have real space pairing and superconducting. So there has been a development, and it has been there at the theory level. Okay. Now that's when this new system comes. Okay, this is something, you know, very fascinating from phenomenology point of view, superconductivity. After 1987, the highest transition temperature was held by cuprates, and you know, you had some family of cuprates. Then from an unexpected corner came the discovery of superconductivity in iron-based material. When you think about iron, you always think of ferromagnetism or some iron oxides, which are very non-conducting, non-metallic. Here is a situation in which you create an iron system, which is also a layered material. Then you get superconductivity. And then and there are very good signals that it's also a Mott insulator in which carriers are added. So if you look at the phase diagram, you may be familiar with the phase diagram for cuprates. It looks very much like cuprate superconductivity. So this is what happened in 2008. After this, Chinese colleagues took over, and the whole field has really progressed enormously, including the new discovery that I will mention. Just to get some idea about what is going on, fortunately, also have a square lattice of iron atoms. So you notice iron atoms sitting, the red atoms, they are forming a square lattice. So you are essentially trying to create a Mott insulator by expanding the ion-ion distance and then having one or two electrons in some atomic orbitals of iron. So it turns out, in order to create this strongly correlated system, you'll have to avoid wave function overlap. Like if you take copper or aluminum or mercury, there's too much overlap, and very quickly you form a Fermi C. Here, you avoid Fermi C formation by introducing strong correlation, and then create some kind of Mott insulating state, and then encourage superconductivity. So the whole starting point is very different. That's where this idea of doped Mott insulator becomes very, very important. So there are chemical details like, you know, the arsenic atoms are sitting above and below, and then if you take one iron atom, it's tetrahedrally bonded. So there are lots of interesting exercises in modeling, and finally you want to get a minimal model, a simple model which will describe as effectively as possible the basic physics. So now slowly things are converging, and then we have some understanding of this system. A little bit of quantum chemistry, it's important. Okay, they are derived from a Mott insulator. In fact, this was a controversy for a long time. At the beginning, in fact, I think, do I have a reference? So I was one of the first to point out that even though the material that you get is metallic spin density wave, you could modify it by small perturbation, like negative pressure, and there will be a parent Mott insulator. So originally, there was no consensus. Now, thanks to new experiments, and many of these iron arsenate materials can be viewed as Mott insulator derived. I can explain it to you. For example, there are neutron scattering experiments which tell you that iron carries in the metallic state the moment of 1.3 Bohr magneton. It's not a gentle spin density wave, so there is a strong tendency to form local spins and Mott localization. In fact, the system that I'm going to deal in detail is a Mott insulator. So the idea is that this is the valence state of ion, and then it's 3D6, that is ion 2 plus. So this is very important. So there are four holes in the D shell. Now, if you look at the electrons, six electrons in the D shell, depending on the environment, they can be in spin 0 state, or spin 1 state, and spin 2. In fact, if you look at iron 3 plus in many, many complexes and compounds, these are all possible states that you will see. Now we will see that the system that we are going to consider, the physics chooses this as the ground state, and very interesting things happen. Now, just to give an idea about other systems, systems that have, you know, given high temperature superconductivity, this family. And then from an unexpected corner, K3C60, buckyballs when you mix it with alkali atom. Then, so these are all odd number of electron system, because if you look at the ionic state of copper, it's 3D9. This is also 3D9, and in K360, it's also 3 electron per C60 molecule, so it's an odd electron system. And this is an even electron system. So at the beginning, it was thought that even odd electron systems like cuprate or K3C60 are seats of high temperature superconductivity. But as always, nature showed through this beautiful example that it could have this interesting physics through this even electron system, which was a discovery by the Japanese colleagues. Now, this is what I'm going to talk about. This is a new system. And the system looks very similar to cuprate, this iron arsenate family. So the physics also, underlying physics also should be similar. And there is a famous Chevron phase compound, Uemura plot, which is the following. You plot the transition temperature as a function of Fermi temperature. Like if you take mercury, it will be somewhere, or aluminium, it has a very high Fermi energy, and the TC is here, it's low. Whereas if you reduce the Fermi energy by making the bands narrower, you find the TC goes up. So conventional superconductor like BCS superconductor fall in some corner here, and all the new discoveries, so-called strongly correlated system-based superconductor, fall in this line. So high temperature superconductivity is here, famous heavy fermions are here, and Chevrel phase and other compounds, and the newly discovered iron arsenate superconductors are here. So suggesting the physics of this material is something to do with strong correlation and absence of Fermi surface or destruction of Fermi surface. Okay. Then there are many new families of systems that are formed. I will not go into the details, but this is the one that I'm going to discuss. So in fact, right at the beginning, within 2 months, I wrote a theory suggesting that it's a Mott insulator base, and then independently, a little later, good friends Elihu Abrahams and Chima C came up with similar theory. And okay. Now, this is a similarity between the two. Now, in parallel, as this was being developed, a new system was discovered by M.K. Wu and collaborators at Taiwan. Incidentally, M.K. Wu is one of the discoverers of these 90-degree cuprate superconductors. So he said that you can have a new system that, you may remember, I had iron arsenide. So the chemical structure is this. So there is a layer of lanthanum oxide and layer of iron arsenide stack. Here, arsenic, if you remember, in the periodic table, is below nitrogen, arsenic, and so on. And then you have oxygen. Sulfur, selenium. So what was suggested by Wu was that you could actually have a situation in which instead of a trivalent arsenic, you can have divalent selenium, and then just have this layer superconductor. This also became superconductive. So the system became simpler, and its experimental behavior started looking like a Mott insulator. Beautiful magnetic ordering, very large moments, and so on. So this is a beginning. Now, this is a recent discovery in last December, and whatever I'm going to say next will be on this system. This is amazing how progress takes place in material science in unexpected fashion. So what these people did was they tried to take this compound that was discovered by MKU, and they tried to intercalate. There is enough space, and you can put sodium atoms or potassium atoms so that they do some charge transfer and create some kind of doping. So they try to do that. Then the end result was they could intercalate, but something unexpected happened. What happened, they found that the process of intercalation removes iron atom from the iron plane in a beautiful and periodic fashion. So you try to intercalate it, the minimum energy state is a state in which there is a periodic array of vacancies. In this picture, I'm showing only the iron atoms, not the selenium atom. Not only that, and they were able to grow good single crystals, and they found very interesting magnetic state in which by neutron scattering, you see that the spin of ion has jumped from 1 to 2, a larger value. Not only that, and within this cluster, the spins are pointing parallel, and then there is a very large moment, and these moments are staggered. So you have a spin 8 moment here and spin 8 moment in the opposite direction. So what you have got is probably the only antiferromagnet based on compounds like this in which you have a very large moment and also antiferromagnetism. So the discovery of this paper was that this system, if you take it and then dope it, you get superconductivity. So the physics is somewhat like in cuprate, but you have a peculiar situation in which there is a very strong antiferromagnetism in the background. It's not spin half that we had in cuprate, where you could think of quantum fluctuations. It's spin 8. So the question is, how does a system manage to create superconductivity in this particular situation? And here, experimentally also, they showed that this is a Mott insulator. That is, you cannot apply simple band theory. What you find is electrons are very strongly correlated, and there is a gap in the excitation spectrum. So it's a Mott insulator. So now, the theory that I'm going to develop is for this particular system, where skirmions and so on will come in a very natural way. So people have done very quickly a neutron scattering experiment to show that the spins have spin wave dispersion, and you can estimate various exchange constants, and very quickly everything has been done. And what is remarkable is it's a very robust antiferromagnetic order. If you find out from neutron scattering order parameter, it keeps going, and probably it will vanish at 1,000 Kelvin. So it's a very large Neel temperature. However, it is cut short by something that's going on here. And then if you look carefully, what happens is, at that particular temperature, around 600 Kelvin, the vacancies start getting disordered. The beautiful quantum chemistry comes into play. I said that there are vacancies, and these vacancies are not static objects. There are some very good, beautiful quantum chemical reasons for that. They start moving around above 600 Kelvin. Once vacancies start moving around, the spins are not stabilized in S equal to 2 state, and it's as if things quantum melt, and then the rich physics of antiferromagnetism and other things do not happen. So this is a remarkable phenomena. Now there are people who have done detailed experiments. I should show this experiment. It's very important because when you look at these materials, one of the first way of sampling, finding out what's going on there is resistivity. What you find is the resistivity is very unusual. It tries to, it's insulating like, and then it plummets down, and then you have superconducting. And somehow this existence of this maximum is correlated with the superconducting PC. So this is the experiment. And of course, all these are all in bad single crystals. They have not been able to create excellent single crystals like in cuprate, but there is some progress going on. So then again, in some better samples, then HC2, what is this one? This is some optical conductivity, which also shows you that there is a Mott-Hubbard gap. And then people have done night shift, which shows this resistivity. This is, and angle resolved photo emission, you find some kind of very diffused Fermi surface in unexpected places. I will not go into the details. So night shift indicating some spin gap behavior like in cuprate and so on. Okay. Now I will come to the theory. And it turns out quickly many friends wrote theory papers, and most of them focused on iron and its 5 orbitals or 4 orbitals, and then tried to develop a theory. The way that my theory differs is in the following way. That is, the question is, where does a doped electron go in a Mott insulator? Now, the important point is, when you build a minimal model, you should not take too many degrees of freedom per unit cell. You should take the relevant, what quantum chemists call as a frontier orbital, which is involved in the electron dynamics. So if you look at phenomenologically, the minimal model for low energy physics should involve these 4 ion atoms forming a spin 8 moment. So F4 placode is a basic building block. It has an electronic integrity as seen from the large spin 8 moment, and then the interaction among themselves. So now I will build a simple microscopic model based on this phenomenology. So that we can ask the question, where do the moments come from? It's very complicated. In fact, people, anybody who has worked in cuprate, you will remember the fight at the beginning. One band was suggested by Anderson, and then the rest of the community said it's five band, and then slowly three band. Now it's considered as one band. So here again, a situation is very similar. There is iron with four or five orbitals, and then there are neighboring arsenic, which is strongly chemically bonded. What do you do? But that's where you go into the phenomenology. Then what you find is, at the end of the day, from experiments, what you see is, you take the iron cluster, F4, so many electrons are parallel. 16 electrons are necessary to create a spin 8 moment. They are all forming some kind of slated determinant state within the cluster. But what is important is there is one state which is isolated, which is at the Fermi level. So if now, since you are interested in dynamics, when you dope the system, you have to ask the question, where does the dope the electron go? From phenomenology point of view, what you find is that the dope electron go into a non-degenerate single orbital at the Fermi level. Now, to derive it from microscopic, it will be very hard, but experiments indicate that this is the model. So which is what I will start with. So instead of all my friends who started with so many orbitals per unit cell, I will start with a minimal model in which you have one orbital per F4 plug. Then life becomes easier. This is, let me first discuss the case of a Martin serrator. So what you find is you separate each spin 8 moment as a core moment and then a valence moment. So this plus this will be a spin 8, this will be a 7.5, this will be half. And then they are exchange coupled. And then there is a coupling between the core moment and the valence moment. Now if you make this larger, you get the standard Heisenberg Hamiltonian of a spin 8, which you can understand. This separation is necessary now because you are not stopping with the Heisenberg model, you are going to a doped Heisenberg model. And doping will take place through this degree of freedom. So which is what I had schematically shown, that you have some kind of core spin, and then you have a valence spin, and all the actions of doping will touch this valence spin degree of freedom. This is something that chemist friends do normally, but when it comes to solid state physics, our people do band theory and then take bigger baggage, which is painful. Okay, so I have already told you what is the thing. So now, after putting all these things together, the relevant Hamiltonian is of an isolated orbital in the iron plaquette, whose dynamics is determined by this very simple tight bending model on a square lattice. And then the spins living here are exchange coupled like this, and then there is a coupling between the core spin and the valence spin. Now, of course, there is a very important constraint that this dopant cannot move freely, so there is a double occupancy constraint or zero occupancy constraint because you are considering electron doping. Now, if you look at the quantum chemistry of this, this becomes a very beautiful TJ model, which is very popular in the context of cuprate. TJ means there is an electron hopping, but it is a very constrained thing that only one electron can be there at any given time. There may be holes. In this case, there will be doubly occupied site. And then two neighboring sites, which has one electron each, has an exchange coupling. Now, on top of that, these electrons are coupled to some large core spin. So this is the model. And this is a beautiful model in which skirmion physics will come in a very neat way, as I will show. Now, if you take this model seriously, there is a problem. You will find that antiferromagnetic garter blocks whole delocalization, and this problem has been addressed by Anderson, Hasegawa, Zener, Dijon, and others 60 years back. And they found out a way by which things happen. Okay. Now let me, first, before I go into our system, this is a 1 minute introduction to Skirm model. Tony Skirm, he wrote down a model for baryons, namely protons and neutrons, starting from a phenomenological model of pion field. So this is a famous nonlinear sigma model. And then he wrote down by hand phenomenologically some terms. And then this action supported solitonic excitations. and because the order parameter is not a simple vector, it's kind of a SU2 or SUN matrix, you find very non-trivial. The mathematics is not straightforward. But at the end of the day, what you find is it supports excitations, which are topological, which has this homotopy property. This is something very simple, you know. In condensed matter, we are not used to it, but this is fairly straightforward. If you have a vertex in a superconductor, you sense the vertex by going around in a loop which is far away from the thing. Then you say, that is, the homotopy classification of one vertex, two vertex, or minus one, minus two is given by this. So here, you map a line into the order parameter space, which is theta in the case of a superconductor, which goes from 0 to 2 pi. Now, in our case, or in, when what Skirm did was, you have an order parameter, which is a matrix, which varies spatially. And then you don't map the boundary, but you map the entire bulk of three-dimensional space onto this order parameter space, and there is a non-trivial winding. So as some people say, it's like taking an orange and then covering it with a piece of cloth, but in higher dimension. It depends on how many times you can cover it. So this is what Skirme did, and a lot of developments and so on. I don't know much about it, so I'll not go into it. In our case, we have a very similar situation where baby Skirmions come. So what we have is an antiferromagnet with a very large spin. So the sublattice magnetization of, let's say, the blue sublattice is a vector. And then you make a continuum approximation, and then you normalize the vector to unity. So your low energy physics is given by dynamics of this N vector field. And then if you write down the free energy or action, it looks like this. Well-known sigma model with O3 symmetry in 2 plus 1 dimension, 2 spatial dimension. So this is our model for Heisenberg antiferromagnet. This is well-known. I will not go into the detail. It's like doing spin wave theory, nothing more than that. But many other nice things come in this formalism. So you have collective excitations which are Goldstone modes. And they are not topological. They are propagating block-like state. But there are also baby Skirmions. In fact, this model was discovered by high-energy physics colleagues to simplify matter. That is, if you want to understand a 3 plus 1 dimensional real Skirme model, you better understand this 2 plus 1 dimensional baby Skirme model. And it turns out there is a condensed matter realization of this baby Skirme model, which is this system. Now, what are the topological excitations? Yeah, they are this. This is very simple, actually. In our condensed matter language, you focus on a sublattice magnetization. In an ordered state, all the spins are up, let us say. Now, what you do is you draw a circle and then say that the spins inside the circle are down. So what you are creating is a block domain. Then you smoothen it out. That is, instead of having a very sharp boundary, you say that as you start from here, the spin continuously turns and then develops a pure x component, and then it turns up to an upspin configuration. So you have a very smooth, continuously varying. Now if you map this to the order parameter space, it's very nice. That is, you identify infinity, the boundary, with the north pole. Then as you move slowly inwards, you will be covering circles like Arctic Circle and so on around the north pole. Then when you come to this circle, you'll be covering the equator. And then when you go inside, you will come to the south pole. So there is a very beautiful wrapping of the spins in order parameter space, in real space into order parameter space. And there is no hole. Everything is completely wrapped. So this is supposed to be a non-trivial homotopy corresponding to Z equal to 1. Now you also notice that there is a sense in this particular mapping. For example, if I go in this circle, as I go clockwise, my spins also turn clockwise. In other words, the order parameter space, I go from east to west. But I can imagine a configuration in which, as I move around here, I go from west to east, like my returning home next week or the end of this week. So they define two chirality. So these are all two different mappings. So they correspond to Q equal to plus 1 or minus 1. Now, this is in terms of words. But mathematically, you give me an N-vector field, I can calculate the number of windings by evaluating this integral. This is called Pontryagin index. So if you take the n vector and take its derivative, x and y derivative, cross product and dot product, integrate over all space, and Pontryagin showed that this integral is always an integer, 0, plus 1, or minus 1, or plus 2, or minus 2. So this is a very important number in mathematics and also in physics in our context. Now, how does this help in creating superconductivity? This is a very important question. Okay, now let us see. Suppose I take this antiferromagnet, which is a very robust antiferromagnet, and add an extra electron like I do here. So I have a large spin 8 here, and I have added an electron, which is a spin half. And this spin, of course, is a baby spin. It would like to be parallel to this because there is a very strong ferromagnetic exchange between this added electron in this black weight and this core spin. Now, if it wants to hop quantum mechanically tunnel to this place, there is a big exchange barrier because here the core spin is pointing in the opposite direction. So an electron, if it wants to keep the spin the same and wants to hop, there is a huge barrier, which is about JH, some Hund's coupling. So the hopping, keeping the same spin, is completely blocked. So you notice that the bandwidth of the added electron gets narrowed down because of this exchange coupling, and there won't be any conductivity. But however, we would like to gain kinetic energy by conduction, so the system wants to do gain energy. So now there is a dialogue between the spin system and the electron system, and the spin system tries to adjust itself to gain kinetic energy. And that is mathematically the following. This is at the heart of the double exchange theory. It is true that if my neighboring spins are anti-parallel, and if the electron that I have added has a very strong exchange coupling, it is true that the hopping is zero. But however, if I make a very tiny adjustment, if I cant the spin or develop some angle, then, as shown by Anderson and Hasegawa, that I get a hopping matrix element, which is cosine times this particular angle. So it is theta by 2. That's what is important is this factor 2. It's because the thing that is hopping is a half electron system. This is a famous expression from Anderson and Hasegawa. So in other words, self-consistently, whenever you add a carrier, the system will deform its antiferromagnetic configuration. In the process, it will lose some magnetic energy. But as long as it gains more kinetic energy, it will do so. So it's a question of energy minimization. Now the next question is, what kind of deformations are allowed in this spin system? That is where the collective topological excitations come. You can create arbitrary excitations, but then may not give you eigenstates. So if you, for example, you can create a Goldstone mode, which is an eigen excitation, then you can make use of it and travel, because Goldstone mode also involves some distortion. There is some energy gain. But it turns out a better energy gain is there in this particular configuration. Let me show it in real space. So I have this the red circle tells me that spins are pointing up. The blue circle tells me that the spins are pointing down. So the Z axis is perpendicular to this plane. So I have created a skirmion in which here, in this subladder, the spin is down. Okay. Now, I had a circle in which I had a vertex here. This is my smallest circle. Now, what you find is, if I add an electron here, you immediately find that because the angle is not pi, there is a small deformation, there is a hopping matrix element, so the electron will happily run around and also visit this neighboring site. So you gain delocalization energy. So you can calculate it and equate and find out what is the energy that you gain and what is the magnetic energy that you lose. You can compromise, you can optimize it and get some size. But what is interesting is this object is intrinsically topological, even though it's on a lattice. So how do we see this? There are actually various ways of seeing this. For example, in the context of antiferromagnet or polyacetylene, what you are doing is you are going from one vacuum to another vacuum through a domain wall, and go back to the original vacuum through another domain wall. So if you look at one electron states in the presence of this domain wall, what you find is it creates two localized states, which are topological in origin, and then they trap two unpaired spins. So this is well-known physics in the context of polyacetylene and spin-density waves. So topological deformations pull out some states from filled band and put it at the chemical potential. So now if you do some experiment, you will find that you will find some unpaired spin here, and then you will find another unpaired spin here, which you can see experimentally. Now this becomes a great place in which you can add external electrons. Suppose you want to remove an electron, you won't remove it from here because it's too deep below the Fermi level, so you can remove this electron or remove this electron. So doping touches the domain walls. So you create defects at the domain walls, and they can become mobile and do very interesting things. Suppose I remove an electron here, what you find is something interesting. I have created an extra charge, namely positive charge, but there is no spin there. So I have created, by this process, an excitation, a domain wall, which carries excess charge, but no excess spin, because in the neighborhood, everybody is paired up. So this will be a charge without a spin. And for example, if I look at this alone, without removing it, it will be a spin without a charge. So this is underlying physics of spin charge decoupling. So it can happen in an ordered background like this also. Now it was shown by Sajiv John and Basu and others, and by me in a different way, that if you take a skirmion, and without skirmion, the antiferromagnet has a gap like this, then once you put skirmion, it develops two gaps, two states here, and in which things are filled. So this is the secret of two spins getting decoupled from the antiferromagnetic background when you create a skirmion and ready to trap charges. And this number two is very important because it's this which is capable of holding two electrons. Now one can make it more formal, but start with the model that I started with, make some kind of slave particle approximations, and then go to continuum limit. I will not go into the details. What you find is this work that good friend Paul Wigman did becomes very useful. He computed for a situation like this. If there are dope carriers, what will be the charge that will be induced? And he found that it is this, because this is related to the skirmion density. And then finally, skirmions will carry a charge which is twice the electric charge times this Pontryagin number. So this is something important. So I will not, finally this amounts to saying, in real space picture, that you have a region in which spins are twisted into two pi twists like this, and then there is a localized state that is formed here, and this region traps two electrons, just for energetic reasons. Okay, yeah, it's understandable. For example, if you think about this as a one-dimensional spin system, your spins undergo a two pi twist, and each pi traps one spin. Just that. In fact, if you do one more, you two pi, it will become a skirmion of charge two. In fact, I discuss this in detail in this particular paper of mine, 2002. Okay, now let me, I'm completing my talk. So this is the beginning. That is, the idea is that experimentally, there is a, what people find is a formula. That is, you have an antiferromagnetic order. In the presence of antiferromagnetic order, superconductivity occurs. So we know how to deal with a spin liquid state like in Q-ray. Here, there is a rigid antiferromagnetic order. So if in that background some pairing has to take place, a distinct possibility is skirmion superconductivity that I have suggested. Now, this is a schematic phase diagram I have drawn based on this theory that I developed. But however, there is an experimental question. Half the community believe that experimentally there is no coexistence.
For which system are you talking about right now? This
KU.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking about the schematic phase diagram.
But this goes back to like a year ago or something like that.
Last December.
Okay.
So it's very recent. So
the community believe I should maybe take it to the grain of salt, right, this time?
Exactly. So half the community believes that it's coexisting, and half the community, like Imai, not far from here, in McMaster, he believes that it phase separates. But I believe, I have looked at the data, for example, a lot of these 2-3 STM results are there, but they are very surface sensitive. So there is no final word from experiment. But what I wanted to point out, theoretically, this interesting possibility is there. Now, to me, it's very exciting because even if this doesn't take place, if this large spin physics is there, there's a very interesting possibility if you go to heavy doping, there is ferromagnetism. Because this is something that we learn in magnetic physics, that where you have a core spin, which is 3/2, and then you have one valence electron, and there's beautiful, nearly room temperature ferromagnetic metallic state. There you are living in three dimensions, so skirmions are different. There you have monopoles which are very expensive, so the system doesn't go into that state, it goes into ferromagnetic state. So here, once you do more doping and once you disturb the antiferromagnetic too severely, that will definitely happen here also, there will be ferromagnetism. So, according to this theory, if you can do controlled doping, if you don't see skirmion superconductivity, you'll see ferromagnetism, which will be very interesting from various point of view. And unfortunately, people have not been able to do a controlled work on this axis. But they are working hard. But, 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a conference in Taiwan where all these experimental colleagues had come. They were quite excited and they are trying to do experiments. Even more exciting is that because of the physics that they talked about, there is also, within the skirmion picture, you can imagine that spin triplet pairing. It's an allowed possibility. So this is only a schematic phase diagram that this system should be taken more seriously. And because this is the first system where you have such a large spin in the background. And of course, the intuition is that once you have two larger spin, things will become classical. And you won't have superconductivity. There will be decoherence and so on. In fact, that will be my intuition if somebody had asked me the question before. But experimentally, if the experiments are true, in spite of having a large spin, I managed to develop charge coherence by constructing this kind of Cooper pair. So if you go along this line, what you find is lots of possibility of pseudo-gap physics that appeared in cuprates will appear here. For example, if this picture is true, you will find skirmions way up to 400 degree Kelvin, which are Cooper pairs. So you will see things like anomalous Nernst effect and various things. So in fact, some experiments are being tried to see if this picture is true. If this picture is true, it has lots of other consequences. And if this picture is true, it will be one of the first situations where you have Cooper pairs which are topological in origin. Thank you very much. Exactly. So they are preformed to bound each. They are confined by the skirmion texture. Okay, let me. Yeah. Essentially, if you think in terms of localized states, what you find is, like in polyacetylene, you had a localized state close to this domain wall. Here you have a localized state strongly peaked in this place where the skirmion that size is there. So two electrons are trapped there, and they will avoid each other, of course, and then go into some relative angular momentum state. And that's a Cooper pair. Then this entity has to tunnel. In fact, if you calculate things like tunneling matrix elements, they are very small. So it's like a preformed pair, which is a boson, and it has the right tunneling matrix element, which gives about 20 Kelvin, 30 Kelvin easily. So it's an extreme case of, I do not know of any other case where you have this kind of preformed pair. Even in cuprate, because it's already spin liquid, so it's very dense singlets. Here you have, to begin with, in some region, a gas of skirmions. And they have to cohere to give a superconducting state. So at the moment, experiments are necessary to confirm, disprove this. Right, exactly. Skirmions move, yeah. Okay, that's a very important question. So, if you have, they do so beyond a critical doping. So this is a question, similar question was asked in the context of cuprate by Shreeman and Sijja. They said that you take an antiferromagnet, add a small amount of gold. They said long-range antiferromagnet will yield and you will get a spiral state. And then even that spiral state will be destroyed beyond a critical doping. Now the question is different here because you have a larger spin. And then further, the Coulomb repulsion and the other physics gives, stabilizes the size to the skirmion. Now once you give a size to the skirmion, then you can show that for small density of skirmions, you don't destroy long range order, which is consistent with the experiment of what you see. Exactly. So self-consistently they are. So the picture will be, if you add two electrons, you'll create a skirmion and an anti-skirmion will run away. So like in polyacetylene, you take polyacetylene, double bonds alternating. You add from outside an electron that carries a charge and spin. At the end, you will find a spin and then a charge, for example, here. So this will be the spin and then this will be the charge. So this is a picture. If somebody can do tunneling experiment, you tunnel an electron, for example, you create a skirmion, anti-skirmion, there only one electron will be trapped. Formally, yeah. I don't know the details, but exactly. At the introduction, yes. Sorry. Too early. Excuse me. Yeah. The two groups who have done the neutron scattering, the Chinese group, this is, I think, powder in which they could see the Bragg peak and get this. And the inelastic neutron scattering experiment.
And it looks like it's flat up to,
about
50 Kelvin or something.
Correct, exactly.
So this looks like some kind of anisotropy gap. Because it's flat, right? So in 2D, you'd expect a much softer curve, right?
Yes.
So how does that...
So if you look at the Goldstone mode, there is also a gap, which could be an anisotropy gap, in very similar scales.
Right.
So that's one possibility. Another possibility is, in fact, it is tied to...
That would prevent the spins to go...
Right. To that extent, so that will define the size for the skirmion. If you look at the skirmion energy, in a pure O3 symmetric model, the size can be anything. Scale invariant. Whereas once you put an anisotropy or a magnetic field, that gives a scale and then it controls the size. So the experimentalist claim that this flattening is an indication that superconductivity sets in. But it's also, as you say, could be anisotropy. Detailed theory and analysis has not been done about this. There you see many features, like if you do two-magnon Raman scattering, you start seeing the Raman two-magnon peaks getting affected below superconducting TC. So that's people are attributing it to coexistence. But it's a very fascinating system. Just by vacancy control, you are able to do so many things through vacancies.
Other questions? Let's thank the speaker again.